Engineering News, the most widely read publication in biotechnology, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Joseph Graves, Jr. from North Carolina A&T State University about race-based medicine. Is it fact or fiction?
Dr. Joseph Graves, Jr. is Dean of University Studies and Professor of Biological Sciences at North Carolina A&T State University. He received his Ph.D. in Environmental, Evolutionary, and Systematic Biology from Wayne State University in 1988. Dr. Graves' research concerns the evolutionary genetics of postponed aging and biological concepts of race in humans. His books on the biology of race are entitled The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium, and The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. Dr. Graves, it's pretty much scientifically accepted that there is no such thing as a human biological race. Craig Venter, who was one of the important research team leaders in the effort to sequence the human genome, emphatically made this point a few years ago. Most biologists and physical anthropologists would agree with him. Why then does one still hear talk, even among some scientists, about people belonging to one biological race or another?
Well, I think there are two general problems that result in the claim that biological races still exist in the human species. The first is that, unfortunately, many biomedical researchers aren't really very familiar with the discussion that's gone on about the concept of race in the biological sense. Therefore, don't know the debates, don't know the evidence, don't even have a working definition of what a biological race is. And so therefore, what they tend to do is they tend to confuse the socially constructed races that operate in the societies they live in, and they assume that they're legitimate biological entities, simply because the social concept isn't challenged in day-to-day life. And without reference to the scientific literature, and having a rich understanding of the population genetics behind biological races, they lapse into making that confusion in their research. The second problem is that when one looks at a broad variety of biomedical research data, since it was collected under the assumption that you were dealing with or collected from populations that are biological races, people interpret their results as if they reify that idea of race. So we start out with a concept that is confused and with researchers who aren't really aware of what population and quantitative geneticists mean when they talk about it, and that makes its way into the popular literature and unfortunately still in the scientific literature.
Okay, I'm sure we're going to get back to this issue of why some people still use this term, biological race. But looking at research and some recent developments in genomics, how much of a role has the study of a variable genetic response to pharmaceuticals, which is also known as pharmacogenomics, how much has that played in the rise of the concept of race-based medicine?
Well, again, we have an example here of what's called ascertainment bias, in a sense that if you actually look at the results of pharmacogenomics, you don't get the idea that there's such a thing as race-based medicine. For example, in a review of pharmacogenomics that appeared in Nature Genetics in 2004, Tate and Goldstein examined a variety of drug classes, which included things like ACE inhibitors and the drug Bidil, vasodilators, beta adrenal receptor blockers, calcium channel blockers, beta adrenal receptor agonists, and so forth. And when you look at the broad spectrum of drug classes that have been examined with regard to the idea of there being racial responses, looking at studies that included 22,000 subjects of European ancestry, 6,000 of African American ancestry, 22 American Indians, and 72 Asians, you come to the conclusion that only one of the drugs tested from all these subjects had a reasonable genetic basis with regard to the groups that were claimed to have a so-called racial difference. Five of them had reasonable physiological explanations, but no demonstrable genetic one. Five consistently had neither a physiological or genetic claim, evidence to back it. And four of them were false positives, meaning that once examined, that the racial claim disappeared. So looking at that, you wouldn't come to the conclusion that racialized medicine is even real based upon pharmacogenomic results. And again, people look at populations and they have results such that there's a particular genetic variant found in one population but not found in another, and then claim, okay, this is, racial medicine. In fact, that's not what it is at all.
Okay, now if this is only one case where there seems to be a pharmacogenomic genetic link with a disease, then on what basis have a number of physicians and researchers seen a correlation between race, genetics, and disease?
And again, we're going back to this question of the definition of race. Well, let's start with defining that. When a population geneticist thinks of race, they're thinking of two criteria by which races could be identified in a species. The first has to do with the amount of genetic variation within groups claimed to be races, compared to the amount of genetic variation between the racial groups. Now, if there was more genetic variation between them than within the groups, then you would say, okay, we have a situation in which biological races exist. Now, it is well known that that is not the case in human genes, particularly genes that are coding genes. That simply doesn't exist in our species. You can find particular loci for which that's true. Don't get me wrong. So, for example, you might find a locus in which in a particular population you find that there's a predominant allele, and then you look at another population and that allele is at very low frequency. So those cases exist. And in the case of where that gene might be associated with a particular pathology, you could get the impression that you're looking at a race-based response. But when we look at the overall characteristics of human genes, and since most of the diseases that we're interested in are polygenic, not single gene effects, we see a case of where that kind of variation, that simple, plus presence-absence variation simply doesn't tell the story. The other way that you could identify a race is whether you can claim that by descent, you have a unique genetic lineage. In other words, that Africans are uniquely different from Europeans, who are uniquely different from, say, East Asians. And that's also not true in modern humans. Now, you can use non-coding genes to determine ancestry and come up with lineages that seem to be more different than similar based upon non-coding genes, but that's not the case with regard to coding genes. Now, clearly, when we talk about disease, most of what we're interested in is going to be the things that occur in sequences that are coded, not the non-coding genetic information that's accumulated in eukaryotic cells. So long and short of it is, while people may find particular genetic variants that differ between populations, they certainly don't differ with regard to the way we would define races using biological criteria. And also, one of the biggest problems that's rarely discussed when we talk about race, genetics, and disease is the question of how one determines genetic causality to a disease incident to begin with. The fact that two populations might differ in a particular genetic variant that has been associated with a disease isn't evidence. that the disease differential you see between the populations is the result of the genetic difference. And when we talk about humans, this is particularly important because we know that in large societies like the United States that do have a significant amount of ethnic diversity within them, we also have strong environmental diversity and strong socially defined variation, which is associated with people from different ancestries. So since these things are not uniform, in other words, you can't say that persons of African descent in the United States and persons of European descent in the United States exhibit or are exposed to the same set of environmental circumstances, you can't say that any differential in health that you see between African Americans and European Americans is a result of genes. I mean, in other words, you'd have to have a society in which the principal population groups for which you're interested in examining health disparity are really experiencing the same environment. And we know that that's not true in the case of the major ethnic groups in the United States.
Now, we're going to pick up on that a little later, genetic influences and health disparities. But I read where you draw a distinction between personalized medicine and racialized medicine. Can you explain the difference?
Yes. Again, going back to the fact that genetic variation is real, individuals all have genotypes. Those genotypes may predispose them to a particular disease. The fact that given individual may have a genotype which predisposes them to a disease or allows a particular drug to be work more efficaciously for that individual does not mean that a group of people who have been socially identified have the same genotypes. So in other words, racialized medicine would work if you could be sure that every person who is socially defined as an African American has the same genotype. And we know that that's not true. For example, there was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine just earlier in 2006, which looked at individuals who self-identified as African Americans in the city of Cleveland. What that study showed was that only 6% of the individuals in the study who self-identified as African-Americans had a majority of their genetic markers indicating African origin. Now, on the other hand, 93% of those persons who self-identified as European-Americans had the majority of their genetic markers originating in Europe. So that depending on the population, one's personal identity might in fact be more likely to be shared by other persons in the same socially defined group. But in other populations, like, say, African Americans, for example, the fact that you have a personal genotype does not guarantee at all that you share the same genotype with others who have been socially identified as being African Americans. So it really does depend upon the degree of genetic variation that exists within the group. And since I started out saying that for human beings in general, there's more genetic variation within groups than between them, it's unlikely that you can infer a person's genotype by knowing their social identity. Just as knowing a person's genotype who has a particular social identity won't tell you what the gene frequencies are in the group that they've been socially identified with. In other words, you're making elementary logical fallacies when you attempt to conflate personal genotype with a socially constructed racial group.
Now, in 2005, the FDA approved Bivil for use by Black Americans suffering from heart failure. The approval was based on clinical trial results and a recommendation by an FDA advisory committee. What do you make of the FDA's decision in light of your views on racialized medicine?
Well, quite frankly, I think the FDA's decision was scientifically invalid. I think there was a great deal of political pressure placed on the FDA committee to make this decision. Also, the motivation behind the inventors of Bidil Nitramed to market this drug as a racialized medicine really had to do more with patent protection for Nitromed than it did that Vital was a specifically African-American drug. When you looked at the clinical trials themselves, initially the first trial was done in a group of veterans who differed in ethnicity, and Vital was very close to being statistically significantly better than the pre-existing treatment in that general population. And in fact, as I remember, the p-value, the probability value in that study was 0.90, and it really needed to be 0.95 to demonstrate a superiority. So it's very close to showing results in a general population that were better than the pre-existing treatment. Now, for that to be true, it must have been that Vital helped a significant number of people, many of whom were not African Americans. So in other words, there is a genotype and there is an environmental set of circumstances for which Vital works well. Now, it turns out that in that initial study, it was highly significant for the subpopulation of people who self-identified as African Americans. And in the subsequent heart trial, African American heart trial that was done at the University of Minnesota, the results were so strikingly better for persons of African American descent that the trial was actually stopped midway through because the results were very good. Now, do these results mean that this drug is solely for African Americans? And again, the previous results indicate that that is not true, that in fact Vital could help a significant number of people, not just persons who are socially identified as African Americans. And unfortunately, one of the results of labeling this and marketing it as a racial medicine is that if it's not tested in other groups of people, for example, Vital may not help Western Africans at all. But if you assume that it's a, quote, black medicine and try it on persons in Western Africa, okay, you might find that there's absolutely no significance. And on the other hand, it might help people who are East Asian, or it might help American Indians. We won't know if the drug is treated as a, quote, racialized medicine. So the result itself doesn't indicate that you can find a drug which is specifically targeted to individuals of a, quote, given race. And, of course, the other thing that people don't recognize is even if this were true, it would not indicate that the reason the drug worked for this so-called race was due to differences in genetic variants or the frequency of genetic variants in those populations. You could just as easily be acting on environmentally induced differences that occur in those groups. In other words, if you look at Vital itself, it's a drug that combines two. It's a pill that combines two drugs, one of which is a vasodilator, and the other is an antioxidant. Now, it could be possible that persons of African American descent, for a variety of reasons, are suffering more oxidant damage than persons not of African American descent, and this could in fact be an environmentally induced insult, not a genetic one. And how would you know? And I think the problem, of course, has been with the marketing of Vital, and the approach is to assume that what Vital is treating is actually a genetic difference between populations, and in fact, I don't think there's much evidence that that's true.
Now, you've pointed out that making a strong case for genetic influences on the health disparities we see among different human populations is not well supported. Could you elaborate on this and suggest what other factors might be responsible for these disparities?
All right. Well, the first thing that we have to recognize is what kind of research program would have to be engaged before we could make a claim that we're looking at a genetic difference causing health disparity. Now, this goes back to basic quantitative genetics, and that all the phenotypes, all the physical attributes of organisms we see result from the interactions of genes, their environment, and the higher order interactions of gene and environment. Now, what this means is that if you were going to test for a genetic causality in a phenotype, you would have to grow the organisms in question in a common environment for at least two generations. And that's to reduce maternal effects, which can be quite profound on adult health. So, for example, in my research, which was in fruit flies and in the genetics of aging, we could not do any experiments for which we could claim a genetic influence on aging where our flies had not been reared in two common generations. And this goes back to the early days of quantitative genetics in the 1930s. So we've known this for a very long time. Now, when we apply this kind of metric to the studies that have been done to claim genetic causality in humans, it's very clear that no such experimental design exists. In other words, for the groups for which health disparity has been claimed, we cannot show that two common generations of environment have ever existed. Nowhere in the world, and certainly not in the United States. In fact, the few studies that have looked at the heritability of lifespan in ethnic groups, and again, heritability is a measure of how much of the lifespan of individuals in the population result from the genes that are coding for how long they live versus other environmental factors. When we look at those kinds of studies, the heritability of longevity in African Americans is exceedingly low. The number comes out around at 0.15, with one being completely genetic, zero being completely environmental. What this would say is with a heritability of 0.15, about 15% of the lifespan differential in African Americans is genetic. 85% is environmental. Now, it's not much better for the other ethnic groups that were studied. So when we looked, that study looked at Hispanics and European Americans also, and their numbers were higher, around 25% and 30%. So what that tells you right away is that longevity in humans isn't strongly determined by their genes. It's, at least under present societal circumstances, is mostly strongly influenced by their environment. But certainly, when we compare this amongst the ethnic groups for which health disparity is a concern, we find the group that has the lowest heritability of their lifespan is African Americans. So to expect then that the health disparities we see in various disease categories are really resulting from the differences in gene frequencies found in these populations seems nonsensical when we look at these kinds of data. Then, anyone who is aware of the social history of the United States and the ongoing discrimination with regard to key aspects of life that influence, you know, health and mortality, such as where you live, African-American children have 8 times the amount of blood lead compared to other ethnic groups. Now, do we think that this has important health impacts? Of course we do. We know that lead has a variety of impacts, including being associated with diseases like diabetes. So when we look at things like stress, okay, we know that socially induced stress influences a variety of diseases. So it seems far more reasonable when we look at the variety of environmental insults that are differentially visited upon persons who are socially subordinated in the United States, including African Americans, Hispanics, and American Indians. It's far more likely that the health disparities we see are resulting from these differences in environment, which are large, compared to the small differences in the overall genetic composition that human populations, subpopulations have with each other. In other words, someone who is looking at the entire picture would never have even begun with a presupposition that health disparity is predominantly genetic. And unfortunately, most of the discussion on health disparity has focused on the genetic issues, when in fact, probably, what we're looking at is a small contribution due to genetic differences and a very large one due to environmental differences.
So, well, Dr. Graves, my final question is, there is obviously a great deal of human genetic diversity around the world. Is there another way of looking at genetic differences meaningfully from a medical perspective without relying on the idea of race-based medicine?
Yes. Again, we want to be circumspect with how we group individuals. And certainly, we can show that there's geographically based variation in a wide number of loci that are, you know, associated with disease. To take those groups, however we define them, we need to understand how much genetic diversity there is, instead of assuming that these populations, however defined, are uniform. And unfortunately, the biomedical research community has had too much of its focus on the idea of the uniformity of difference between groups rather than the diversity within them. So I think that what is needed is a real survey of the genetic diversity of the world's populations, which, in fact, at present we don't have. I'm sure that your readers are aware of the international and efforts to begin to acquire such information, but we're still a long way away from having real fine detail of the genetic variation around the world. Too much of the claims of racial difference are really based upon samples that are not representative of the groups that they claim. For example, many studies of human genetic variation are based upon samples from localized regions of sub-Saharan Africa, samples from China or Japan, samples from Northern Europe, and very few other places. So if we were to actually look at what human genetic variation looks like, we would be sampling in a systematic way along the routes of major human migrations through history. So not just sub-Saharan Africa, but also the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia, the Americas, and so forth, so we could have a much better picture of the frequency of variants. And when we do that, we will be able to get a better handle on how that genetic variation might be contributing to the specific diseases we find in various populations.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like to hear your opinions on the issues discussed in this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following questions. Do you believe in a biological basis for race-based medicine? Why or why not? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, be sure to visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next Thursday.